Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Well, Happy New Year. Welcome to a great new year. If you get a chance, check my frequent alert, my wonderful, wonderful, wonderful listeners from around the world. And it's a video I took accompanied by what a couple of folks have said sounds like poetry, a little bit of a description of the video, some incredibly beautiful and threatening weather, and some comments on how all this relates to the excitement and anticipation of a new year. Remember, folks, it's never been easy for us humans. Every new year, even before we could calculate them, brought new expectations, new fears, new challenges, new things to accomplish, more things to do to take care of the family and to live life. And that's what life is about. It just doesn't get easy. It keeps coming at you. But if you're blessed and if you're lucky, it gets richer. It gets more worthwhile as the years go on. And that is definitely my discovery at age 81. It is better than ever. You need some luck. You need some blessings. You need good fortune just to get to be 81. But the general principle is if you work at life and try to take more and more charge of it, more and more apply your best principles to it, and then just, you know, some of it is just given to us or not, but if it really maximizes the opportunity for us to have the best possible lives when we love with all our hearts and try with all our hearts and try to do good as best we can on this earth. Didn't expect to be saying all that, but there it is. And check out my ever-growing, ever-changing website with just lots of new information and new faces on it. I'm developing my new honored blog series. The first one up is by the remarkable Peter Gerze from Denmark. So lots going on in my life. I had an incredibly busy few weeks. Somebody decided, a judge, to start a trial on January 2nd. I'm recovering from that. We're moving, and Ginger's mother, Jean, is coming to live with us. Now, you're not supposed to be happy when your mother-in-law comes to live with you, but I'm very, very happy, and she's been with us a few weeks now. And it's really wonderful to see Ginger and her mom together. Her mom helps us laugh, helps Ginger laugh. Ginger's very serious. I'm very serious. And we're just looking forward to just developing a wonderful shared life together. And, you know, I'm 81, but mom is only 10 years older than me. She's 91, Ginger's mom, and I feel like she's my mom. And she's a wonderful lady, and she's extremely intelligent. She spent her whole life doing and taking care of others and the environment and her church and her community in Indiana. And now she's come here to be with us, and she's raring to go to become more involved in this community as well. So wish us well with that. I wish all of my wonderful, outstanding, incredible listeners on the frontiers of what's best in mental health, psychology, psychiatry, and all the other human fields, I wish you a wonderful, wonderful year ahead. My guest today, Tony, are you there?
I am.
Well, Tony Stanton means a lot to me. He wouldn't know that because I'm really sometimes not a very, very good friend. I went to look up when was the last time I had Tony Stanton on my radio show, and I've never had him on my radio show. I was shocked. So I went looking for when did I last even write something about Tony Stanton, and I actually found the first time I wrote about him, and that was in Reclaiming Our Children. And I give about 4 or 5 pages to his work, and Tony, also to the Kitsap Mental Health Center. Is that still around?
Well, that's still around. I'm not working there anymore, but yes, it is still there.
Well, maybe we'll hear a little bit about that if it's still working on good principles. And Tony was written up also more recently in Bob Whitaker's Anatomy of an Epidemic. He has done some of the most sterling and heartening and heartfelt and good work in our field, period. And he's a psychiatrist. He's a child and adult psychiatrist. He's spent a lot of his time in a program in California, from which he's now retired. And I want him to be talking about that program today. It is, to me, was the flagship. It was the flagship for how to treat and help the most disturbed, delinquent, light, angry, hostile, everybody giving up on you children in the world. And he's going to talk some about those principles. He's going to talk about empathy. He's going to talk about what he's doing now in his own practice in Washington State on this marvelous Olympic Peninsula. I mean, if you've never driven around Olympic Peninsula, it's an amazing experience. It's one of those great places. And so he's got a wonderful place to live, and he's trying to help people struggling with the psychiatric establishment. I mean, can you imagine taking that on when you're a senior like myself? We're senior wise persons, or I'm not sure, you know, but we're seniors. And he's taken on that kind of level of job now. And he's also just knows so much about child trauma and how it contributes to the misery of children and adulthood. And he comes out of the establishment. He has completed his training at Langley Porter. That's out at UC San Francisco. And that was one of the programs I considered going to when I was graduating decades ago.
Oh, wow.
I think I decided not to go out to California. you know, Tony has just done such incredible work, and I want to involve him more in my life now. Welcome to the show, Tony. Did you even remember that I'd written about you in Reclaiming Our Children at some length in 2000?
Yes.
I had to go back and look.
yes, that was right after we had had a meeting of the organization where I presented a paper on doing residential treatment with children.
Yeah.
And I think that was when you began to have some contact with me and my work.
So we go back about 17, 18. We actually go back, it sounds like, 17, 18 years
or
so.
We go back at least 19 years, I would say.
God, well.
Yeah.
May God now strengthen our relationship.
Indeed.
I really want to do that. There's so many things I wanted to talk to you about, but
I thought I would start by telling you, telling everyone a story of a meeting that I had a couple of years ago with a lady who came in to see me who had had a series of very difficult situations in her life, and she had gone to get help for those situations, and they had placed her on a cocktail of antidepressants, benzodiazepines, and various things, and she had decided she wanted to get off of those. And we had mutual friends, and they said, well, maybe you should go see that guy, me. And so I met with her, and she told me this story of what had happened to her. And I said, well, just tell me the whole thing, what happened. And at the end of the meeting, she said, do you realize that you're the first person who has actually listened to me? And I felt, well, this is tragic. And, of course, I was able to help her get off of these medications and to just look at what options she had in her life. And she's turned out to be a very successful person.
And how long ago was that?
That was a couple of years ago.
But you've been doing this work forever.
Well, you know, it reminded me of how the whole issue of how do you hear somebody's story? How do you relate to people? And why did I think that was important? So I thought I might go back and look at some of the events that occurred in my life that led me to this. I came out of a family of physicians. I had a grandfather, a father, an uncle, a cousin. They were all surgeons. And I thought that if there is an art to medicine, that they had a very particular interpretation. Their idea was to find out what's wrong and remove it surgically. Anything to do with their lives or emotions was considered to be irrelevant or maybe even an impediment to their job. So really the solution to all problems were cut it out. And in fact, in my family, I have to say that all of us were subject to a variety of surgical interventions that took place from my father and grandfather, et cetera. But there was something about all that didn't fit with me. And I think very early on, I began to sense that there was more to listening to people and finding out their stories than just trying to fix them. So when I, this is kind of a prelude to what happened finally, when I got into working in residential treatment with children. But the whole thing, in a way, started before medical school. When I went to, I was invited to participate in what was called an externship at the University of Southern California. And they wanted to do a very an interesting study, a study that I don't think anybody would think of in these days. They had an acute psychiatric ward where people came in with all sorts of psychotic episodes and other problems that led them to be hospitalized. So what they wanted us to do was to take these, to choose these people that came in and find out everything that we could about their lives in the 2 or 3 months before they were hospitalized. And, of course, it was really fascinating what we found out. It was the stories that we got about these people's lives was remarkable. And we also would go out and speak with their relatives. It was like a very high-powered social work type thing that we did. And we wrote all, I don't know what happened to it. I don't know if it was even ever written up, but it changed me because it allowed me to see that these people that were designated as having psychiatric problems had actual histories in their lives. And it was important to know what had happened to them. So
I think that you know, that is just so profound, and yet it's just getting lost again and again, and it's being eradicated from our profession of medical.
Well, that's right.
Docs,
that's
psychiatrists,
right.
And I think almost everywhere there's less
absolutely.
And less listening.
That's right. It's you know, typically when I see people that have been to even their primary care doctors, they'll maybe see them for 15 minutes. At the end of that, they'll be prescribed something. I thought I'd share a little bit about what happened to me in medical school, because this again involved my family. When my brother, who was about 17 at the time, for some very good reasons, became very obsessive. And the story goes that at one point he went to see a psychologist, and my father wanted to know, what did the psychologist do? And my brother said, well, he wanted to know more about what was going on in the family. And my father said, well, we can't have that. I'm going to send you to a psychiatrist. And indeed, he found a psychiatrist in Southern California who then placed my brother on a really amazing cocktail of antipsychotic drugs. And he started, when that didn't really remove his stress, he began giving him shock therapy two or three times a week. This was kind of horrifying to me, and I guess at one point my brother tried to run away from the treatment, and he got into an argument with my father, and my father said, no, we need to hospitalize him. So my brother was sent to the county hospital in Los Angeles, and that happens to be the hospital where I was doing my medical school, and we had a psychiatric rotation that we went through. Oddly enough, I was doing the psychiatric rotation at the time my brother was hospitalized there. So I talked to my professors, who at that time were actually very psychologically tuned. They were not typical of what's taught now, or the teachers now. And they said, sure, we can help you, because they were going to take my brother to a court and have him committed to a state hospital. So they helped me identify a private hospital. I'm not even sure this exists now, but that would have a different philosophy. So we went to the court hearing, and during the hearing, they had a couple of older guys who had interviewed my brother, and they said, yes, he's paranoid schizophrenic, no question about it. He needs to be going to Camarillo State Hospital. At which point I stood up and said, well, you know, you could do that, but I think that we do have another option here. There's a private hospital that would be happy to take him in. And they really had no valid objections to that. So my brother was transferred to this private hospital, and the people running that just happened to be very enlightened. And I think the first thing they said to my brother is that you're not crazy. They said, in fact, one of the things we're going to do right away is to get you off these medications. The other thing we're going to do is to help you find a place to live, because one of the things you cannot do is to return to be living with your father. And well, my brother's had all sorts of adventures since then, but he basically was able then to go to college and to become a landscape gardener. And that whole experience kind of gave me a taste of just how unfortunate the psychiatric treatments could be.
Yeah. It's so important for people to realize, it's got to be said again and again, that psychiatry is not a science. It does not progress through wisdom, learning, research. It is an arm of the pharmaceutical industry. It's financed by the pharmaceutical industry. And the more and more powerful the pharmaceutical industry has gotten, the worse and worse psychiatry has gotten. So that when I was in training and Tony Stanton was in training, there were actually places where you could associated with universities at times,
yeah,
where you could
absolutely
go and get some kind of decent help.
Absolutely.
Where people would talk to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's after, gone. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, after that experience, I had been designated, I think, as the next surgeon in the family, and I had to finesse my way out of that. And by the time I had moved to San Francisco for my internship, I had pretty much gone on a path of exploring psychiatry. And I ran into people who were very compatible with my way of looking at things. I'm trying to think of... I ended up, finally, after a period in the Air Force, of as you mentioned, at Langley Porter. And at that time, they were doing very careful evaluations of families. And I would paraphrase it differently than they did, but I would say that they were really getting as full a story as possible of what was happening in the family. And starting to engage all the members of the family. So if we were evaluating a family, we would take 4 weeks. We would meet with all the members of the family each week, and we would take 4 hours for these evaluations each week. So this is a little bit different than 15 minutes of finding out if your child is ADHD. And that led me to start working in inpatient work with children in San Francisco. And I wanted to see whether or not we could form longer-term relationships with these kids by pairing them with staff. And making sure that they always knew who this stable person was in the hospital. And we were very successful, I would say, in both engaging these children and their families and getting them to stable living environments. So it was kind of that work that led to me to begin to work in residential treatment, and the agency where I was working was as Peter mentioned, they were taking in all the failures of the other agencies, and we made it very explicit we were going to treat these children by engaging them with high levels of staff. And when we were going to remove all medication from their care, this sometimes would result in some interesting interactions. I remember one child who had a reputation of just tearing every place apart, and we were interviewing him, and he said, "Well, what you're going to take me off these medications?" So I said, "Yeah, I think we're going to just slowly get you off." He said, "Well, you better not do that." He says, "Because I'll destroy your program." And I said, "Well, we'll just have to take our chances here." I think the kid was around 9 or 10. About 2 weeks later, he came in with his parents, or his parents came and visited, and they asked how things were going, and he looked at them and he said, "You know, I think these people know what they're doing." Which is a great confirmation. And actually, one of the hallmarks of that work was instead of saying how can you stop this behavior, we would ask how can you engage that behavior. And that meant that you really needed to put yourself right front and center with whatever was disturbing that child right then. And that was universally successful with these children. And it also the other thing which you also mentioned, I started doing something called a table of life events, where I would go through every piece of paper that I could find on that child's life, pediatric records, psychiatric records, sometimes CPS records, and then I would put that in a sequence from before they were born to the present. So each for instance, one of the things that was always interesting to look at was that they had been on multiple psychiatric drugs. And so what I would do is say, okay, the drug was started here. This is the reason it was started. And then we would see what happened. And then, oh, well, now we got a second drug because that first one didn't quite work. And then we have a third one. And this often went concurrently with a diagnostic escalation, I would say. They would start with, well, we think he's ADHD, so we're going to put him on these stimulants. And but then that didn't quite work out because they weren't really targeting the trauma or the issues that were involving that child in the first place. So then they would go to, I don't know, maybe it's maybe he's also depressed. We'll put him on an antidepressant, which often made things worse. And then they said, well, no, actually, okay, we mean he's bipolar. He needs, the whole different class of medications, the lithium included. And then when that didn't work, they would say, well, he's talked about voices and things. He's psychotic. We'll put him on some antipsychotics. So by the time these children got to us, they were frequently on 7 to 9 medications. And I kind of developed a whole protocol of how to gradually remove all those. And it would be very interesting to see the staff would say, this kid... he really is kind of a zombie. Well, let's see what happens. And within a few weeks, as we were starting to remove all these medications, they would say, oh, we see who he is now. We're getting a real idea of who this child is. It was kind of like releasing him. I would say that over the years, I evaluated probably over 450 children, and they all had this kind of presentation. But it was very gratifying. I think it's very important to point out what was going on with the staff that we worked with. They became very convinced that they could make a difference, and they would... you would see them, we would bring a new child in, and there was a certainty in the staff that, well, we're going to be successful here. We're going to engage this child, we're going to find out who they are, and we're going to make a huge difference in their life. And they did. Unfortunately, the program came to an end because it was very expensive. It cost a lot of money to have that level of staffing. And eventually the counties didn't want to pay for it.
After how many years?
Let's see. We started in around 87, and the program came to an end in 2011. So about 23 years or so.
Do you think that was the real reason? I would guess that if you did a proper accounting of these children and what they really would have cost the state if they hadn't passed through your program, that you're probably saving people the state money, but they don't think that way.
There's no question that what you're saying is true. But this is the problem that we're facing with a lot of, public programs these days is that they're interested in how can we save something short-term, not whether long-term it's really going to be to everyone's benefit to make an investment in this child's life.
Yeah, and it's also, that the drug industry can't tolerate this, and they just have such power in the state legislatures as well as the Congress, of course, and I'm sure in the administrative places in the state, too.
Totally. I did a presentation for a group here in Seattle one time just to have them take a look at the power of the pharmaceutical industry. And so what I did was I brought in an issue of the APA journal, and I said, and I just said, now let's take a look at what these articles are like, but let's also look at the kinds of advertisements that are in here, and what the advertisements say, and of course they would have pictures of people being treated or talked to by someone, with the explanation that, that their lives were now manageable because they were on these medications. It's really something to look at the amount of advertising that is in one of these journals, and there's very little in the journal. I have to say it's very rare that I came across. That I have come across an article that I really want to read. Because, again, it's based mainly on a statistical analysis of a group of patients, clients that are not, that is, I would say, cherry-picked. And what we know now is that a lot of these alleged success stories of these medications is based upon a selective choice of I'm looking for this term of you do a study. Let's say you do 8 studies on a medication.
Oh yeah, just don't only publishing the studies
but
that
only
work
publish the ones that looks like you got a 55% increase in something that's just a little bit better than the placebo, and well that's enough. That's actually wonderful. We're going to sell this drug.
Yeah, and it's only working because the placebo is a sugar pill rather than something that has a physical effect so you can feel you're getting
exactly.
The drug.
Exactly.
And also exactly. So the doctor can't tell whether you're on the drug or not because you have got some drug symptoms.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
No, it's all such – the more clear it gets, the whole thing is a fraud and a fabrication. And I love the fact that Peter Goetze, with all of his establishment experience in Europe now, is writing books like Deadly Psychiatry, now that he's starting to look at psychiatry, not just medicine, and coming to the same conclusions. We're seeing some openings, but it's a fraud of such a gigantic proportions that it's very, very hard for people to hear it or to believe it. And what you're describing is absolutely what's required to help the most disturbed of the disturbed kids. You got to help their families. And then you got to get them off the drugs, which they put on, which have made them worse and worse and worse. While everybody thinks it's the kids getting worse and worse, and it's just it takes a caring input. But folks, in the long run, it really is cost saving. And even if it weren't, it should still be what we do.
Exactly. Yeah, I had a. I'm just remembering certain stories. There was a One time at one of the mental health centers, I was getting ready to leave one Friday evening, and I got this call from a clinician. I said, "Well, could you prescribe a sleep medication for this little girl? She's 9 or something." And I said, "Well, I don't. I think I need to know a little bit more about her before I thought of prescribing anything. Do you have her chart?" And she said, "Oh, yeah." And I said, "Well, I'm going to take it." And I took it home, and I did one of my charts on her, on one of my tables. Well, it turned out that she had a very disturbed father who had kidnapped her and her siblings and kept them in some farm someplace until the little girl escaped and got the police involved, and they incarcerated the father. But at the time that I received this call about her, the father had recently been released from prison. And the fact was, this little girl was terrified that this guy was going to come back. So when I got all done looking at this history and putting it together, I said, "Well, we need to have a plan. You don't need a sleeping pill. You need a plan. And we're going to make one." So we made a plan about how we were going to keep her safe wherever she was. And this allowed her, of course, to sleep.
Wow.
But it was that idea that they weren't looking at the context of why this little girl was having trouble.
Yeah, I have a sleeping pill story that I've told before. My wife reminds me that I've said so many things and written so many books that I really shouldn't be embarrassed about repeating myself, because no one's going to have heard it before. But it's
right.
So on target for this,
which
is that I had a session, this many years ago, this was back in the Bethesda days, so it's probably 25 years ago or so. A patient called me in the evening after she'd been in, and she said, "Can I get a sleeping pill for tonight?" And I said, "Oh, golly, we didn't talk about that today." And I said, "How come you didn't bring it up today in the session?" And she said, "You weren't listening today." I said, "Oh, my God, thank you for telling me." I said, "Why don't you just come in tomorrow, and tomorrow will be free, since today was apparently worse than useless. Come on in tomorrow, okay?" And she said, "Oh, thank you." I said, and you're still worried about sleeping?" She said, no, I'll be fine. I'll see you tomorrow. Thank you so much."
Wow. That's a great story.
It's the same story.
Yes, it is.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Go ahead.
How many? I mean, you feel that you pretty much had success with just about everybody that came through your program?
Yes, I would say we didn't really have any failures. Because again, we were offering sustained engagement. I used to say that we basically offered the children three ingredients: safety, predictability, and engagement. And of course, we could write a long chapter about each of those ingredients. But boiled down to those things, and you really can't have engagement without safety. And it's hard to have safety without predictability. So they kind of, you can see they all go together. But that means you really need staff who are interested and are being encouraged to engage the children. I remember on one incident that I was called to see a boy in a classroom, which really wasn't working so well, it turned out, but one of the staff members said, "Oh, I'm so glad you came. You know, I think what this boy needs is some Zyprexa. You know, Zyprexa is from everything I can tell, the best thing since sliced bread." And I said, well, let me take a look at this boy and see what I think. And so what I saw was that, and I've seen this in many other classrooms, that this boy would start to get distracted, and they would immediately, the staff would immediately begin to try to stop him what he was doing or to challenge him. They did not engage him around what it was he was having difficulty with. He needed someone by his side, looking over his shoulder, saying, well, what do we got here? And I didn't have too much success in engaging that classroom. He eventually was transferred to another room, and he did fine. So it's really
so his disease was his classroom.
Yeah, well, it was, yeah.
He had a classroom disorder for that particular
yeah,
classroom.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, Lord. I like the list of safety, engagement, predictability. It just is a good summary that applies across the board of all human relationships, psychotherapy, teaching, family
yes.
life.
Yes.
In all
yes.
those areas, you want safety,
yes.
you want engagement, and you want
yes.
some degree of predictability.
Absolutely.
Because that
Absolutely.
Ties into knowing you're going to be engaged some of the day or sometimes.
Oh, totally.
Safety, engagement,
yeah.
predictability. I think it's a really, really good little thumbnail that I'm going to try
yeah.
to think about including when I talk about what psychotherapy works, why it works, and what family life requires. It's all very similar. We human beings,
it is. It
we
really
need the
is.
Same things everywhere we go.
We do. I don't know if you – we haven't talked about this, but whether you know you've had much contact with Stephen Porges.
No, I haven't.
Okay,
tell
Stephen
us about
Stephen Porges is a started out as a researcher of heart rates in babies and things like that, and he has ended up with creating a body of work called the polyvagal theory. And basically what that theory says is that by engaging each other, through our voice, through our being connected with each other, we change our physiology. And for instance, if I'm sitting with you, talking to you and engaging you, your heart rate is going to go down. And your blood pressure is going to go down, and this is all through the vagus nerve. It's an extensive theory, but the results.
Well, it's what we used to call
clear.
The autonomic nervous system or the parasympathetic nervous
system.
It's
all about the parasympathetic system,
it's the opposite, folks, of the. Epinephrine, adrenaline, get it
yes.
up. It's not
yes.
fight, but it's also not flight. It's taking
yeah.
time to relax, digest your food, slow
yes.
things down,
yes.
take a nap, enjoy yourself, be peaceful.
Right. Well, it turns out that our bodies are built to connect to each other.
Oh, my God, yes.
And he has another term, which I like. He doesn't discuss it for him that much, but he calls it neuroception. And what he means by that is that when we meet another person, we immediately assess their body state and whether or not they're a safe person for us. We do that unconsciously. That's not something we decide upon. It's like I met a little girl not a couple of years ago who was allegedly autistic, and I went into her classroom, and there was something happened between she and I immediately when she looked at me. And she was with some other people. She said, I want to go with that person. And we became inseparable.
Was she autistic with you?
Well, no, she wasn't. She was hanging on to me.
Autistic children don't like to be touched. They don't like to touch or be touched.
No, exactly. This is why all of these diagnostic labels need to be, we need to be very skeptical about all these diagnostic labels. You need to know who this person is. You need to know what it's like to be with them. You need to know their history, what's happened to them. And to rely on a diagnosis is probably the worst thing you can do. I've probably told the story about a boy who came to us in the residential program, and he came with a lot of paperwork, and he'd been seen at the University of California. In the program I had worked in, but their report started by saying this known bipolar boy, and then they went on to describe. In other words, they said they knew he was bipolar before he even got there. It turned out that he was a challenge for us, but he just needed someone to help him regulate. And it turned out, I remember doing a table on him, and there was a psychologist that had seen this boy when he was four. And he said, the problem here is not that this boy is that disturbed, but that he has become an emperor in his own family. And no one is setting any limits for him. So what we did is we did set limits for him, and he kind of blossomed with our setting limits with him, and turned out that he was allegedly he couldn't learn anything. Well, it turned out he was very bright, and he started doing well in school. He's a child that we were able to get back into his family and teach them how to engage him. But
did you work with the family?
Yeah, we did work with the family. Yeah.
Did you require that as a part of your program? Because I mean, these kids must have been all over from the state of California.
Well, they were from all over, and sometimes, you know, the unfortunate fact is sometimes they didn't have a family.
Yeah. Right.
Sometimes yeah. These poor kids were. It's not a question of blaming anybody, but you know, the unfortunately, the parents had gone to jail for various things, or the parents had been very abusive, and so sometimes they really didn't have a family to go back to, and sometimes we didn't have a family to work with. Most of our work would then end up being with the social worker who was part of the Department of Social Services, who had the authority over the child. But our job was to educate them about what this child really needed so that we could find a placement that would really help him or her.
There's never been an article there's never been any kind of evaluation of your program, as I remember. Do you have data that could be put together if somebody wanted to do that task?
Well, the closest was I did write one paper, a couple of papers. One of them was for some kind of a grant or something that we did years ago when I was still at the program, and I put together a kind of statistical analysis of our success and where these kids had gone and so forth. I think the really unfortunate thing was that when we started this program, we didn't include a follow-up program, a follow-up study, because I think then we would have had something much more substantial in the way of a publication. So I regret that. I'm left with telling people we were successful.
Yeah.
And of course, the part that is clear, and this would be, is that the children who came to us out of control became in control. Another story is a boy that we had who came in who just didn't make it any place, and he had a tremendous talent for finding out something that would be annoying to the adult that was with him, and then really pushing the button. He would make up limericks. He would do whatever he had to get out of whatever situation he was in. He often ended up in a room with another staff separately because he couldn't be in a classroom. But we kept setting limits. We kept engaging him, and I think it was a year and a half or so afterwards. And he also had a therapist that was quite engaged with him. And at one time he got into trouble again, and he went into class and he says, I went into a separate room. He says, I want to talk to my therapist. And so his therapist came and talked to him, and she said, well, what's happening? He said, well, I just realized that I'm a hopeless little bastard. Nothing good will ever happen to me. Well, that was the turning point. At that point, he began to engage his therapist in a very different way. And I would, I mean, it's a long story, but at the end of a few months, he was our leader in the program. He was the kid who was showing the other kids how to do it. It was very striking.
Yeah, well, it's often the kids with spunk and leadership and insight who run most powerfully afoul of their families.
Exactly. Yeah.
I see it all the time in my practice that, the kids in the family that I certainly would like the best are often the ones in the most trouble.
Yes, exactly. Yep, that's been my experience. The other thing I've tended to do more is to see children in their families. I mean, to see them in their homes. And because I get a much better sense of what the space they're living in, the what the relationships are looking like in that home, and whether or not I can actually, you know, how best I can engage all the family members.
Yeah, I wish that I'm sitting here feeling morally reprehensible because I don't do that, because how do I fit that into my life and my income? I think it's just such an important thing what you're talking about right now, and we've got to find ways to deliver that kind of help.
Yeah, it's true. It's you know, I am privileged because I have enough flexibility in my schedule that I can do such a thing. But most people could never do that. I know that.
Well, did you do that recently, or were you doing that when you were working with the kids in California? By the way, folks, I've been so engaged myself that I haven't mentioned we're talking to Tony Stanton, who I think I introduced you, and then
you did.
I never again addressed you. Who's a child psychiatrist and an adult psychiatrist. We've got about probably 3 or 4 minutes. First, are you seeing private patients? Can people get in touch with you and come see you?
Yes, I do. I do. It's pretty limited now. Of course, I get a lot of people calling me and saying, I need someone to manage my medications. And I say, well, you got the wrong person. I said, if you want to get off of your medications, I'd be happy to help you. But I'm not going to manage your medications because that's not what I do. I'm not an expert in that.
Yeah, I basically do the same thing, only I don't say I'm not an expert in it. I tell them I'm expert enough in it to know they're not really good for folks in the long run. And check out my website, and if you change your mind, come and talk to me. I'd be happy to talk to you about the issues, but I didn't want you coming here thinking that you would get medication and then be shocked.
Exactly.
I'll prescribe, but basically for the purpose of withdrawal, if at all possible.
Exactly. That's pretty much what I do too.
You know, some of my patients who come, especially if they're part of a family, they say, "Well, I'm on my 100 milligrams of this or that," and I tell them my concerns about it, but they don't want to come off, and I work with the whole family. Yeah. Most of the patients in individual practice, they just get the idea that, you know, as soon as they start during the first, you know, few cutbacks, they often just start feeling better.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Well, I have to say that the home visit I would like to make is to your house, because it sounds like you're having a good time.
Yes. You know, I do believe there is an invisible hand that at times really guides our lives. We had lived out on the lake for 15, 16, 17 years now, and really loved it out there. It's incredible to live on Cayuga Lake, and that's what my frequent alert is taken. But then we want to live closer in now. We don't want a half-hour drive. We don't want all that weather in the winter. And but I couldn't find a place that looked good for living closer in. Then one day, Ginger came upon a place only 6 or 7 minutes away that advertised itself as being waterfront, whatever that meant, because I just love being on water. Well, it turned out this place is up in a very nice part of town, and it has a brook big enough to at least be on the map, and it has a little pond that was made a long, long time ago out of the brook. Uh-huh. And it has an acre of land, and we could afford it. And we could especially afford it because it had, if in our older age, if we wanted, it had a 1,000-square-foot mother-in-law suite in the basement looking out on the land.
Oh, my gosh.
And so we bought the place, and then we found out that Mom really, really was not being treated the way we wanted her to be treated and the way she wanted to be treated. So I said, "Mom, would you like to come live with us?" I thought it would be best for me to say it, not even Ginger, because it's her mom, and of course she wants.
Yeah.
And she said, "Oh, no, I couldn't." I said, "Why not?" She said, "You can't. I have the dogs." Well, we brought the dogs. Thank you, Tony Stanton. Can people find you on the internet and give you a call?
Yes, they can.
Okay. Uh-huh. God bless you, Tony. Thank you for being with us.
Okay, thanks so much, Peter. Right.
Bye-bye now.
Right, bye.